and had the opportunity to teach mindfulness in a grade 4 classroom in Falls Creek. And I had the children do a bit of walking in the room as if they were roaming through a forest. And then I asked them to stop and become the trees of the forest. And I gave them some guidance, you know, your roots go down now and your branches lift up and the wind is moving your leaves. And maybe a bird has alighted on one branch. And then I asked them to close their, well, they had their eyes closed. And then I said I was going to tap a few of them to become explorers walking through the forest. And that if you were a tree with your eyes closed, not to worry, but that no one was going to tickle you or scratch your bark. And so I did that, and a few of them began, can you hear me okay? A few of them began walking through the forest, and they were having a great time, and they would come very close and then step back and blow on each other, things like that. And then they would become trees again, and others would get a turn. So, and then we had some mindfulness of hearing with bells, and then I played an instrument, and they listened, and then I told a story. So there were several mindful activities, and they really enjoyed it. So they wrote me some thank you letters. This is from Archer, Division 5. To Margot, I really enjoyed the mindful activities. Mindful spelled M-Y-N-D-F-U-L. I really enjoyed the mindful activities, but my favorite one was the tree one because it reminded me of something. And there's the trees. Trees are holding hands. So I was so touched by that. It reminded him of something. So he couldn't quite articulate it. But did it remind him of inner quiet that he'd discovered at some point? Did it remind him of something he'd experienced in another lifetime? I mean, it's so interesting. It reminded him of something. So there is that awakening of faith that takes place when we are reminded of our own potential, our own goodness, our own capacity to meet our experience. And just another example of that is I was at Hollyhock once with my friend Mark Nepo, who was giving a workshop there. He's a spiritual teacher and author and poet. And Mark often asks me when he's on the coast to assist him and tell a few stories. So I had told a story, and to give the story some context, I had quoted from an early Buddhist text. Let me just see if I can find it here. And this is the piece that I had quoted at this Hollyhock retreat. Kappa's question. For one stranded in the middle of the rushing river of becoming, in the flood of great danger, birth, overwhelmed with aging and death, tell me the island, dear sir, and show me the island so that this may not happen again. And the Buddha responds, for one stranded in the middle of the river of becoming, in the flood of great danger, birth. Overwhelmed with aging and death, Kappa, I will tell you the island. Having no thing, free of clinging, that is the island, there is no other. That's unbinding, I tell you, the total ending of aging and death. Those knowing this, mindful, fully unbound, in the here and now, do not serve as Mara's servants, do not come under Mara's sway. So Mara is the personification of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the words are a little bit obscure. This is an ancient Pali text translated into English. And there are a lot of metaphors hidden in this text. For one stranded in the middle of the river of becoming, in the flood of great danger, I will tell you the island. So the island is a place of refuge and safety. And what is that place of safety? It is relinquishing this sense of me and mine. It is mindfulness of the arising of that sense of me and mine. So I gave this quote. It was a little bit shorter than that. And we were in a very secular atmosphere in a workshop at Hollyhock. But my story was Buddhist, I guess, so I gave that context. Afterwards, this woman came up to me, and she was visibly moved, almost trembling. She said, "Where did that come from? What was that text? Where is it? How can I find it?" And she was clearly experiencing a shock of recognition. So this moment of resonance that we have all experienced in some way or another, to some more greater degree, lesser or greater degree, that resonance with the truth, that resonance with a way of seeing that is different from how we have been living our lives, and that awakens something in us, some understanding that there is another way to be. So it's interesting, you know, there are people on this retreat who are coming to mindfulness and this practice for the first time. And when I had been a teacher in Nigeria and came down with malaria and was given a number of anti-malarial medications, and and I really experienced at that time this kind of break with my previous self and a real awakening of a sense of that it was important to respond and be kind and show compassion. And so there was an awakening of wisdom in me and also of kindness. But when I came back to Canada, I really didn't have a way to practice, a way to realize or continue to develop those qualities. And then in my 20s, a friend said, "Why don't you come to this meditation retreat out at UBC?" And I trusted my friend. It was so interesting how trust plays a role. And I said, "Okay, I will." Even though I was I was attending university, I was busy, I had a lot of papers to write and projects to work on, I said, "All right, I'll come with you." And was at the UBC School of Theology, a beautiful old stone building on campus. And the teacher was James Barretts, and I've told this story a few times, but he spoke in a language that was so clear and so welcoming and so invitational and accessible that he actually made it seem possible to me that there was another way of living, that there was a simplicity in this practice of coming back to my moment to moment experience. And I remember going outside, looking out at the sky and the mountains and the sea, and having this feeling of coming home. And that was the awakening of faith in me. And I think that we mustn't neglect those experiences, but instead honor them. And allow faith to be a faculty that is developed. So just as the eye faculty sees, the ear faculty hears, and according to what we do in our lives, we develop the faculty of seeing or hearing, of, for a poet, of using language, of a musician, of composition, of a dancer, of choreography. Just as we develop faculties according to how we use our potential, in the same way, faith is a faculty that we can develop. And we did a bit of chanting this afternoon, some of it in Pali. So, you know, faith can be also expressed as a devotional practice. And for some people, that's, no, I'm not into devotion. Bowing, chanting, that's not for me. But for other people, they can surprise themselves by discovering that it really is an avenue of exploration. When I was at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts, adjacent to the retreat center in the woods, there was a room dedicated to chanting. And if you wanted, you could go, and there were some chanting books, and you could sit and chant. And my friend Greg would often go, and if I was walking by, I would hear him chanting. He was chanting the Metta Sutta, he was chanting the Refuges and Precepts, and other chants as well, in Pali. And he was awakening and nurturing this quality of faith and devotion, which, you know, is manifested in the way he teaches, because he's a Dharma teacher now, and he will be coming to Canada next year to teach. But if you get a chance to sit with him, you will experience the depth of his faith and how it balances the wisdom faculty. So faith is that moment of inspiration, but then there is verified faith. And this is the faith that arises out of actually seeing that our practice of mindfulness is making a difference, that we're less reactive, that we don't snap at our partner or a friend, that we actually are learning how to care for ourselves. So faith, verified faith, is this momentum of practice revealing to us that what we're doing is skillful and beneficial. So faith, and then there's unshakable faith. And unshakable faith arises when an insight, you know, this kind of like, oh, a great deep understanding about some aspect of our lives suddenly becomes clear to us. You know, we understand, oh, that was for my benefit, that experience, and I learned this. So unshakable faith actually removes doubt, and there is no longer any hesitation to continue the practice. So we are balancing these spiritual faculties as a way of supporting our whole journey. So faith leads to energy. And energy is such an interesting one, because we can easily get out of balance with energy. And actually at meditation retreats, teachers will often say, if you have a little bit of energy, why not stay up a bit later? Or do some walking and then come back. And for some people, that is just the encouragement they need to explore the edges and boundaries of their patterns of practice and see if they can extend themselves a bit. What's it like to sit when there's a little bit of sleepiness? What's it like to walk and try and arouse a bit of energy on long retreat? But for other people, those instructions may lead to striving and a kind of willfulness of, okay, I'm going to sit, walk, sit, walk, sit, walk. And when I was on retreat, I went into an interview with one of the teachers, Annie, and I showed her my schedule that I had made for myself. And I was so proud of the number of sittings I was getting into a day and the number of walking periods. And and she said, okay, Margo, here's your instruction. I want you to assemble all the pillows and yoga bolsters and blankets and mats in your room and arrange them so that you have a view out the window. And for an hour, I want you to do nothing but gaze at the clouds. What an amazing instruction. And she shared with me how in her own practice, now she was a very tiny, energetic person, with Sheila, like Sheila's mother, with a lot of energy. You said your mother had a lot of, what is the Chinese word?
Oh,
Ji. She had been, worked in antiques and was always buying and selling antiques and thinking about her business. So when she began to practice, she realized that she didn't know how to relax. So she bought herself a couch. And she would schedule a time in the day when she would go and sit on the couch. And she would try and actually put her feet on the couch and lean back and experiment with what it meant to relax. And gradually, she learned how to do that and discovered that it was a way of balancing that striving mentality that she had brought from her work life to her practice life. So energy is a place where we bring mindfulness to knowing ourselves, to supporting ourselves. And so there is a poem here I have. What makes a fire burn is space between the logs, a breathing space. Too much of a good thing, too many logs, packed in too tight, can douse the flames almost as surely as a pail of water would. So building fires requires attention to the spaces in between as much as to the wood. When we are able to build open spaces in the same way, we have learned to pile on the logs. Then we can come to see how it is fuel and absence of the fuel together that make fire possible. We only need to lay a log lightly from time to time. A fire grows simply because the space is there, with openings in which the flame that knows just how it wants to burn can find its way. So that's by Judy Brown. So this is a metaphor for our own energy. And so the fuel, you know, that energy, that effort needs to be in balance. So, energy, and on your sheets, there's a beautiful quote from Ajahn Sucitto. Use energy in terms of backing up other parami. So parami are the qualities that we're developing on our path of practice, like renunciation and resolve, generosity and patience, wisdom and loving kindness, and virtue. He says, use energy in terms of backing up other parami, such as kindness or generosity. Instead of adding more things to do or get done, deepen the quality of what you put into your actions. In this way, energy used skillfully resources and regenerates the heart. So, deepening the quality of what we put into our actions. So at lunch, I was served a beautiful soup. But not only that, there was a beautiful placemat and a beautiful bowl and vegetables arranged colorfully on a plate. So this quality of attentiveness can be expressed in so many ways in our lives. And we inspire each other. You know, the way we put down a teacup, the way we pour a cup of tea, the way we hand a gift to a recipient. So, and then faith and energy are balanced and expressed through mindfulness. And mindfulness, there's so much to say about mindfulness. And in my instructions today, which I apologize if they were a little bit sketchy, but mindfulness is such a vast topic, but we begin with what is most discernible in our experience, which is really the body. And for many of us, actually, the body is an amazing arena to explore mindfulness, because we've been living in our heads most of our lives. So to notice the body, the sensations that are present, the body's energy or tiredness, the body's need for fuel, the thirst that is present, and the body also, you know, it needs to move. It needs air. It needs light. It needs, you know, the experience of being close to a friend or being in contact with an animal or caring for plants. These are all ways in which the body tells us what nourishes it and what it needs. So we can begin our practice, if we're new to mindfulness, with really landing awareness in the body and letting that be a rich field of exploration. And then there's mindfulness of sense perception. So we're still in the body, but it's specifically noticing the experience of sound or seeing, the experience of tasting, the experience of temperature or of texture. So, awakening and creating some continuity and momentum in our practice means looking to see where is my mindfulness absent and where is it present. And I was speaking in this last group about the tendency, which we very much have in the West, to identify with experience. So a colleague of mine told me that he'd been up at Mount Washington with his family and they'd been skiing. And then, so that launched a whole series of reactions in me, like, oh, how great they could do that. how great that they could go up and be in the mountains and go skiing. I really ought to go skiing sometime. When was the last time I went skiing? I wonder if those boots still fit. Oh yeah, I left my skis in my friend's basement, and I hope they haven't given them away. And so this whole series of stories and making my response into a way of generating a sense of self. So this is a place of mindfulness. Oh, I'm creating a sense of self here. Of course, we need a sense of self to get through the day, but there's a lot of unnecessary self-creation that goes on. And in fact, there's a word for it in Pali, ahamkara, I making. So it's interesting. We do a lot of it. So to be mindful of it, not to judge it, but just to see it. So mindfulness, this vast field of exploration. And recently I've been giving a class, which a few participants came to, about creativity. And my whole intention with this class was to honor that impulse we have to know ourselves and know our experience. I mean, it's not in any way a negative thing to want to know ourselves, but it's when we attach to a sense of self that we see there is suffering. And so to actually honor the creative engagement with writing poetry or writing reflections or drawing or painting or in some way tracking this journey of experience, I think it's extremely valuable. And in that, we may even discover the places where we have identified and created a sense of self in a way that brings suffering. You know, there's a story told of a teacher, and I knew his wife. Hob was his name, was short for Hoblitzel, and he was a meditation teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he'd been an English professor. He was about 15 years older than his wife. And as he began slipping into dementia, she could track the progress of his disease by the poems that he would remember and recite. So at some point, it was Dylan Thomas, "Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light." And so he would still, even though he was slipping into dementia, he still had students and he would still teach them. And there was one evening he was speaking at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, and the hall was filled with his students and visitors, and he was in the middle of a thought and he completely lost who he was, where he was, and what was happening. But instead of falling into fear or panic, he just waited and breathed. And then his thought and his clarity, to some degree, returned. Of course, he wasn't able to do that right up to the end of his life. But at that point, he was no longer identified with being the Dharma teacher who is eloquent and draws on poetry and makes references to literature. He was just allowing himself to be a teacher at that very stage of his life, of his aging. So quite an amazing gift. So we give that gift to each other when we acknowledge, you know, where we are. And, you know, a few of us at lunch were speaking about aging parents. And it is remarkable to spend time with an aging parent and to see them letting go of their identity as the one who is organized, or the one who is tidy, or the one who keeps on top of the recycling or the bills, and just allowing themselves to be patient and to wait, to be receptive of the kindness and generosity of a child. So this mindfulness, you know, it's such a gift, and once we've stepped onto this path, even if we stumbled into this retreat, there's really no going back. Sorry. Because once we know that this is a quality we can develop, more and more we recognize our potential to develop it and apply it. The balm of mindfulness, the medicine of awareness, to apply it in all the arenas of our life. And of course, we're not always going to be mindful. And we will have judgments. I was teaching a grade one class on Valentine's Day, and they'd had chocolate in the morning, and they'd had 3 snow days leading up to this, and they were not very mindful. And there was a group of children making a mess by the sink with glue and water and paper. And initially I was like, oh, I see, it's some kind of art project. But then afterwards, when there was glue on the floor, and I was like, come on, you guys. And I realized that I slipped into an old mode, which is the teacher who lectures. The teacher who almost berates and shows disappointment. I'm disappointed in you. Did you ever have a teacher who said that to you? You could have done better. Anyway, so that's what happened. And forgiving myself, forgiving the children, and remembering that, okay, that was an opportunity to be mindful of what was happening and see if I could step back and find a creative way to address the situation in a manner that was loving and friendly, and actually reminded them of their ability to actually participate in creating a better result. So these faculties are ongoing supports for us, and I think we've experienced how mindfulness creates the collected mind. Someone in the group was referring to a degree of quietness and subtleness that was beginning to be noticeable. And actually it was so interesting because what she was saying was that there were awarenesses and insights that were coming up and questions. So it's an obvious truth that when we settle down, there will be more clarity. And the image that is often given is of the turbulent stream, and entering the lake, the water becomes clear and we can see to the stones that are sparkling at the bottom of the lake. So this clear thinking, this concentration leads to clarity, clarity leads to wisdom. And wisdom is, this is what we're doing. We're on a path to really uproot the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion, and to free the mind. So I'll just finish the talk with this quote from Utejaniya. So Utejaniya is a Burmese monk, and he is the principal teacher of my teacher Steve Armstrong, also the teacher of many people here, and my friend Laurie and I were fortunate to practice with Steve last year, and to experience the extraordinary gift of his teaching as he was given a diagnosis of glioblastoma, brain cancer. So to know a teacher as an extraordinarily astute and sharp and eloquent and skilled instructor in the Dharma, and then to see his encounter with the health diagnosis and the effect on his use of language, and to see him still as an extraordinary teacher because of the way he met his experience. So that was our gift in the last months when Steve was giving retreats. So Utejaniya says, don't worry about the defilements. So the defilements, those are sloth and torpor, grasping and aversion, restlessness and doubt. These are the defilements, these habit patterns of mind. He says, don't worry about them. I like that instruction. Don't worry about the defilements. They are always there. They're going to come back. They're going to reappear. Practice to grow wisdom. Practice to grow wisdom. When wisdom is strong enough, it will remove the defilements. So these are the habit patterns of mind, like grasping and attachment, like wanting, the habit of desire, or the habit of aversion, of not wanting, or the habit of identifying with experience, or restlessness, doubt, impatience. These are all versions of the defilements. Is that helpful? Yes, well, there are five hindrances, and they're considered, I don't know if the defilements and the hindrances are equivalent, but defilements is anything that interrupts our experience of direct knowing. So, for example, my story of the friend in the ski trip. So that's a neutral experience if he says to me in an email, we went skiing. So that's, but that, the reaction in me was wanting. Oh, I want to go skiing. So when wanting is unseen, it leads to desire, planning, and then self-judgment. I'm like, why haven't I never taken up skiing seriously? I really used to love to ski. A whole story unfolds from that. When all that happened was that he said, we went skiing. So in the same way, we generate a sense of self, we generate a sense of someone who ought to be like this or ought to do that. We judge ourselves, or we praise ourselves. You know, we create a story about who we are. And these interrupt our experience of learning from the moment. Because the moment can only teach us, and we can only grow wisdom if we're here for it. We can only, I mean, how many people were living in Victoria last summer when there were days, several in a row, full of haze and smoke? Was anyone here? So did that arouse any feelings of despair or resentment or anger or bleakness or fear or anxiety? It did in me, and I thought with longing and regret of past summers when the skies would be clear, the air would be fresh, and you even had to wear a sweater in the evening in Victoria. And so what is happening there is I'm actually not meeting my experience. I'm falling into longing and regret. And I'm projecting that the future will be the same. So that those are ways in which I'm not meeting my experience and learning from it. But, of course, in the next moment, I can learn from my longing and regret. So we can be mindful of how we react. But the idea with these hindrances is not to be undone by them, but to see them as arising due to conditions and to continue to grow wisdom. Growing wisdom through our relationship to experience. So often a mistaken notion about practice is that the idea is to become calm and equanimous and I'm unperturbed, nothing's going to ever bother me. Is that possible? I mean, maybe for some people at some points, but actually it's dynamic, you know? Who we are is changing all the time. We're learning, we're growing, we're sliding back, we're slipping back. A few years ago, I would never have had a subscription to Netflix. Never. I would never have let myself be distracted in that way. You know, I would never have become obsessed with a show. But this winter, I got obsessed, you know? And it's humbling to see that, you know? I've now canceled my subscription to Netflix, I will proudly tell you. Oh, that was only a few days ago, though, so we'll see. So, you know, it is humbling. This practice is humbling. And yet it's also enlivening, and it is, you know, I remember in my 20s thinking about how was I going to manage with growing older? You know? And I thought, okay, I'll become a writer and then I'll really have something that will be meaningful to do. But then when I discovered meditation practice and the Dharma and these teachings, I realized this is how I want to age. I want to age in the Dharma so that my experience continually offers me an opportunity to learn and grow. And that I can relinquish, you know, my mobility or even my cognitive ability with grace, to some degree anyway. So let us just sit for a moment before we have our walking period. And I'll just read this Inuit song. So the journey of our lives is also a journey of awareness. Journey of discovery, a journey of insight. Inuit song. And I thought over again my small adventures as with a shore wind I drifted out in my kayak and thought I was in danger. My fears, those small ones that I thought so big, for all the vital things I had to get and to reach. And yet, there is only one great thing, the only thing, to live, to see in huts and on journeys, the great day that dawns and the light that fills the world. Just letting the images, the words settle in. So may our practice of awareness be of benefit to ourselves and to all beings. Thank you for your attention, for your energy, and for your listening.